So welcome to the session. The name of this session is called Insights and Conversations on Countries. And what we've done is we've asked a number of countries and representatives from those countries to give us in a short period of time a little gleaming into what makes that country an interesting place for us to visit. This session, which is obviously focusing on destinations, is one that I sort of feel I fight for every year with Mara, with varying degrees of success. At the end of the day, what we all do, what we all want, is to take our travelers to exciting and new destinations. And so to devote an hour or an hour and 15 minutes to that topic, to me, is incredibly important. So I'm delighted that we're here. I wish there was a few more people in the seats, but hopefully we can gather a few more as time goes on. I understand there's been some flight issues for people coming from New York. But anyway, let us start with further ado. I am Janet Moore. I'm with a company called Distant Horizons. So again, I'm honored to be able to be part of this session, and I look forward to learning from our presenters. And the first presenter we have is Gina Carmo from Inspire Travel, and she is going to be sharing some ideas about Brazil. So thank you, Gina. And each person is going to be talking for an absolute maximum of 7 minutes. It's okay if it's shorter, because if we have time for questions at the end, I'd be delighted to incorporate that. So without further ado, Gina.
Okay, can you hear me all okay? Good afternoon, thank you for coming. Thank you for your interest in learning about new destinations to offer your passengers. And thank you for coming to ETC. My name is Gina. I am American, but I've lived in Brazil for 11 years now. So I'm here just to take a few moments of your time to share a little bit about what you might be able to offer your passengers in Brazil. And whenever we were given the task of choosing only 5 photos to show you all, it was really difficult for me to come up with only 5 photos of Brazil. I was thinking I could offer photos of our Amazon rainforest, of the beautiful colonial cities in the interior, of the wetlands regions of the Pantanal. It was so difficult. And then I started to think about your perspective and that you want to offer things that are unique to your travelers, things that you're not going to find on Google just searching for photos. And so I'm going to show you 5 pictures that sort of just show examples of things that you, as travel planners and as tour operators, can offer your passengers that they wouldn't be able to experience on their own if they were just to travel to Brazil. So Brazil is the 5th largest country in the world. It's larger than the continental United States. Official language is Portuguese. So it's important to keep these things in mind whenever you have a group of passengers who want to travel to Brazil and you're planning a trip there, that the country is so diverse, and getting from one point to another, really plane is the main way that your main mode of transportation. We do not have a train system there. There are some smaller cities that are within driving distance of one another, but airplane is going to be the main mode of transportation. There's 3 main airlines in Brazil to get you around the country. So. Oh, is this the wrong way? Okay, so first photo that I'm going to show you. This photo was taken in Trancoso. Trancoso is something that you should have on the back of your mind if you haven't heard of it already. Trancoso is a town located on the eastern coast of Brazil. This photo was taken at the Quadrado. It's a little open square where there's lots of little fishermen homes around the square and inns where you can stay. Anderson Cooper from CNN has a home in Trancoso, and he did an article last year in Architectural Digest, and in the article he said, "I have worked in 70 countries around the world, and I've traveled to a lot more, and nowhere is like Trancoso. It's such a special place." So I think coming from him, that's an interesting perspective that he has. So this is just a photo of some of the local people there coming back. There are no cars in the center of town. Coming back home on their horses there in the town of Trancoso on the eastern coast of Brazil. Whenever you're thinking about what you're going to offer your passengers to Brazil, I think it's a great way into the culture is always going to be through food. Who doesn't like to eat food? And a lot of people will ask, what is the food like in Brazil? It's so different throughout the country in different regions. This is a photo of a woman who offers a cooking class in the town of Paraty. Paraty, it's P-A-R-A-T-Y. It's a small town that's off the coast, about a five-hour drive from Rio and six-hour drive from Sao Paulo. And if it's not on your radar, put it on there. It's a great little town, a little car-free, cobblestone streets, brightly colored buildings, interesting nature activities, hiking, sea kayaking. You have cultural activities. You can go and do artist workshops there. And a thing like this, like a cooking class. And the cooking class is something that no matter where you travel in Brazil, I think it's interesting to consider offering your passengers. It's just a gateway into the culture and the local life there. If you don't have time to include a cooking class for an afternoon or a night, think of something like a coffee tasting, for example. Brazil is the largest producer of coffee in the world, so you can do something short-term like a coffee tasting or a caipirinha workshop. Caipirinha is a drink made of cachaça and lime and sugar that a lot of local people will enjoy. But this is just an example of some activity that you could incorporate whenever you're... Next topic I'd like to chat about is music. Whenever you think of Brazil, most people think of music. Bossa Nova came from Rio de Janeiro, samba. There's a lot of different activities you can incorporate into your programs that deal with music. You could put a whole program together on Brazil and music. There are different festivals held throughout the year in different regions. If you could incorporate a program revolving around the festivals, they're held throughout in different regions. You could do something on that. And this is a workshop done by a local musician in the town of Salvador. Salvador was the first capital of Brazil. It's a really unique place because there was a lot of African influence there. That's where many of the slaves who were brought into Brazil were brought through that port. And so it's an interesting activity to do, sort of bring your passengers together, is a musical workshop. You could do something like this. You could do something in Rio with a samba school with the percussion instruments. You could do a walking tour to see where the bossa nova came from and learn about life there in Ipanema, the neighborhood in Rio where bossa nova was born. And speaking about Salvador, I guess if someone were to ask what are the top five destinations in Brazil that you should offer or think about offering your passengers. Of course, it's going to depend upon their special interests, but I would consider, of course, Rio, Paraty, that small town that I told you about that's like a 4.5-hour, 5-hour drive from Rio, Iguazu Falls, which is the world's widest waterfalls. It's on the border of Argentina and Brazil. And Salvador, the town that I just showed you the photo of the musician, Salvador is a really interesting place because of the strong African influence there. There were about 10 times as many slaves who were brought from Africa to Brazil than the United States. And so the African culture is really strong there. And it's an interesting place to experience the different cuisine, religion, music that is in Salvador. And then for people who are interested in nature and wildlife, the Pantanal, which is the world's largest wetlands region, that's the best place to see wildlife in Brazil. Moving through some other things that you want to keep in mind when programming ideas are trying to come to a head is whatever opportunities you can get with, of course, a connection with the local people. So this is a photo taken up in the north part of Brazil. That's my daughter bending down there. And so she's become quite the traveler herself that we visited a local indigenous community. And I think that something that you could do is just to tie together the whatever opportunity you can get, if it's going to have a barbecue with local families, interacting with locals. It's really important. Around the world, Brazilians are known for their friendliness and welcoming attitudes. So you have to tie that into your selling point for Brazil is the interaction with local Brazilians. Final photo here is just another interaction you can have by incorporating some sort of social project, NGO work, either doing work yourself, volunteering hands-on, or just learning like this man is doing, learning how banana fiber leaves are made into, he was making a pillow there for a local NGO that's produced by women to sell these products abroad. So that's all I have. I don't have any more time to share with you more info about Brazil. I hope that this sort of planted a seed and might spark some interest in future opportunities that we have there for you. Thanks for your attention.
Thank you, Gina. And I don't know if any of you saw yesterday, but the Wall Street Journal did a piece in their weekend travel section, and I loved the name of the piece because it was called Beaches Without Ego. And it was about the beaches in northeastern Brazil. So you should check that out. Okay, so next up we have Jerry Sorkin. Jerry Sorkin is going to be talking to us about Malta, and he's with Guild Travel. So thank you, Jerry.
Thank you, Janet, and thank you for hosting this. I discovered Malta almost by accident more than 25 years ago. I was living and working and traveling in Tunisia for many years until recently. And just to get an escape, it was a 15-minute flight. I decided to go one summer to Malta, and I was just surprised by this tiny island, which you can really, if you wanted to get, and you wouldn't want to do this, but you could get in a car and drive around the whole main island probably in an hour. But it's such a charming island, you wouldn't want to do that. And I started going back maybe every 3 or 4 months to get an escape, because from Tunis it was a short 15-minute flight twice a week. And I found it was a gem of a place. It's a country that is primarily three islands, the main island, which is called Malta, and here we are. And it overlooks, obviously, the Mediterranean Sea. Its diversity in architecture is really what's, I think, the first thing that captivates you, that in a country that today has about 400,000 people, but historically had less than 300,000. It's on limestone rock in the middle of the sea, yet somehow they've been able to make it green, they have water, and architecture that really reflects the diversity of the many people who have come to Malta over the years, going from the Romans to the Arabs, to the British who were there from the early 19th century up until the early 1960s. So you see architecture that reflects all that, but you also see prehistoric ruins. And when you go, some of the best things to do is to have someone who really understands architecture and archaeology. Because the question when you see this place and you see prehistoric ruins, you have to wonder, how could anyone have built in this place in prehistoric times when there was just limestone rock, no vegetation, nothing. But now it's gone to the point where you have beautiful churches. This is a painting by Caravaggio that's in this St. John's Cathedral in the main capital, in the capital of Valletta, which is a charming town of its own right. Am I doing something wrong here? There are numerous cities, small cities. This is called Medina. And in some ways, it has a little bit of Italy. It has a little bit of Arabia. It has a little bit of Europe. And there's just this unusual nature about the Maltese people. They've lived through many cultures that have come to them. And as a result, they're multilingual, though the language of Malta is Maltese, but everyone speaks English, particularly because of the long British period there. This is Medina. It's called the Quiet City. There are no cars in it, and it's a wonderful city to just walk through and visit the small winding streets. It's not a very touristy town. This is one of the prehistoric ruins. There are several that are quite large. This is Hajar Jim, and they have it all covered to give it protection. So that's one of the interesting programs. The other thing that has really been interesting over the years, Malta, despite having a small population, Maltese are passionate about politics, and there are essentially two parties. And as you drive through the little towns around Malta, and there's these windy streets that take you through one from one town to another, you see signs all year long representing the different parties. And in every town, and remember, this is a country that has only 400,000 people, in every town, both political parties show their politics and their signage. And it's very interesting as a program to meet with people who are involved with the political parties to understand what kind of issues, in a world where we have wars and famine, what are the Maltese so passionate about that they have two political parties? So it's interesting to do that. It's interesting to have a good archaeologist who can help you understand prehistoric ruins plus the other ruins that are in Malta. And I mentioned there are three islands. The second one that has people living on it is Gozo, which is about a half-hour ferry ride. The ferries go about every 20 minutes. And it's just this beautiful green island, very rural. The people are very simple and very quiet. And they're very different. They're called Gozans. And they think of themselves very differently than the people on the main island. And again, despite this small country, the main island of Malta to the Gozans is another world. And they're very clannish. So to have an opportunity to meet with Maltese and learn about some of their customs and how they feel about the other Maltese is quite simple. I'll give you one example. There's very little crime in Malta, as you might imagine. But whenever there has been something and it involves the Gozan, no one talks. It's kind of what we hear about when you see these films with the Sopranos or anything about the mafia, how there's no discussion about anything. The Gozans have this very strict Gozan type of camaraderie. And the last topic, I think, if you want to do programming that really is quite interesting in Gozo, in Malta, is what has transpired since it became part of the European community, a Euro country. It's actually done financially probably better than almost any. It has a rather high employment, not unemployment, but high employment. And it's interesting to find how the Maltese have been able to exist with this, because they're also facing one new problem being a Euro community, which is people coming over from North Africa and different parts of Africa on these rickety boats. Malta is one of the first places they touch land to, and the Maltese suddenly find that they have to deal with this situation. So I'm going to leave you on that, but Malta is a place that is wonderful standalone. It misses seeing Americans. It sees very few relatively, considering it's such a special place. But it's easy to combine with Italy, Sicily, Tunisia. It's just a small gem of an island that Americans have yet to see. So thank you for letting me have the opportunity. Safe, yes. Yes, but if anything happens to you in Gozo, they won't talk about it.
Thank you, Jerry.
Thank you, Jerry. That was interesting. I've never been to Malta. I have to confess, and I've always wanted to go. So thank you for the lovely photos. All right, next up, we are going to switch continents now and move to Africa. And we are going to learn about Ethiopia from Julie Scott. Thank you, Julie.
Good afternoon. I'm so glad that everyone was able to make it here safely. Let's see. So I'm going to be speaking about Ethiopia, and our first slide here is in Lalibela, and it's welcoming you to Ethiopia. And wanted to ask everyone, why visit Ethiopia? It's one of the most beautiful countries that I've ever visited, and it's a real hidden gem that you are going to start to hear a lot about. And some of the reasons are because the economy is doing quite well. It's one of the fastest growing economies in Africa. and they're investing a lot in infrastructure and also promoting tourism. So why visit Ethiopia? Ethiopia is the cradle of humanity and very historically significant. Ethiopians are religiously devout Christians and was one of the first countries in Africa to adopt Christianity. Many people perceive Ethiopia as being a dry landscape, but in fact, about 70% of the country is very lush. They have spectacular architecture, incredible food, not just Ethiopian, but also Italian, because the country was colonized by Italians. So Janet has a favorite story about her roadside stop in the middle of Ethiopia where she had one of her best pasta dishes ever. In the southern part of the country, they have hundreds of indigenous tribes, each with their own culture, dialects, and customs. With the new entrepreneurial spirit in the country, a lot of young people are returning to the country to be part of the growing economy. And as I said, there are many misperceptions about Ethiopia. I'm sure many of you remember several years ago about, you know, the famine that was there. And of course, there is a little bit, but that it's no longer to the scale that it was. And I do want to mention that there is currently a travel warning for Ethiopia, but which is due to civil unrest, but it's being contained and it's not in the areas where tourists go, and so no tourism has been impacted. Our next slide is not in the order that it was supposed to be. This slide is about the religion of the country. Very interesting story about Christianity reaching Ethiopia. It dates back to the time of the apostles, which happened rather accidentally when a Christian merchant from Syria returned from a voyage to India with two young students, and they stopped to get water on the African coast and brought Christianity to Ethiopia, where about 50% of the population are Orthodox Christians. A really wonderful experience for travelers is in the city of Axum, where during the first part of the month, you have early morning processions of religious pilgrims who are dressed in white robes carrying candles, and all visitors are welcome to participate. They're winding their way through the streets of Axum to the St. Mary of Zion church complex, and there's a small chapel in the complex where it's the Ark of the Covenant is supposedly rests in a well-guarded chapel. And one of the best times of the year to visit Ethiopia is during January for the Timkat Festival, which is celebrating Epiphany, or the birth baptism of Christ. This slide is showing one of the rock-hewn churches in Lalibela. These churches were not carved from the rock, but were carved in it. They date from the 12th and 13th century. And every part of the church has been carved, from the columns to the doorways to the decorations, including dimly lit passages and crypts. All of the churches still have services performed by the priests who are dressed in these beautiful, colorful royal robes. This slide is the Blue Nile Falls. The source of the Nile, one of the sources of the Nile, is here in Ethiopia. And these are the Tiziat Falls, which eventually meet up with the White Nile and then flow all the way to the Mediterranean. Another really breathtaking thing to see in Ethiopia is the Simeon Mountain National Park. Am I running out of time? Oh, I have one more slide. This is a photo of the indigenous tribes in Ethiopia. This is the bull jumping ceremony. It's a rite of passage for young men in the Hammer tribe. And what happens is 15 to 30 bulls are lined up side by side, and the young man must run across the backs of each of the bulls. And I'm sure you're wondering what happens if he doesn't make it. He's actually teased and whipped and then must try it again until he makes it. And just quickly in closing, you know, Ethiopia, the best time to visit is in the fall and the spring, and it has a mild climate, reasonable costs, few visitors, and infrastructure is really being promoted. So it's a really wonderful destination.
Yes, so the meal that I had, one of my best pasta dishes ever, was in the Simien Mountains. We were driving through, and this was quite a few years ago, so the roads were not very good, and we'd seen nothing. I mean, just gorgeous, gorgeous landscape, and we have to stop and get something to eat. So it was a truck stop. I mean, literally a truck stop in the middle of nowhere, 50 trucks. I thought, what on earth? What food can they possibly produce? And they said, well, what do you want to eat? And I said, well, what do you have? And thinking it would be injera, because we'd eaten a lot of injera. But they said, no, we can do some pasta. And I said, okay, bring the pasta on. It was superb. I mean, it was just a bowl of pasta with a tomato sauce. But somehow that tomato sauce, I don't know how they cooked it. I mean, obviously it was organic tomatoes, and there was garlic and olive oil because the Italians had been there. But they're in the middle of nowhere in Ethiopia, an incredible bowl of pasta. So I don't know if the truck stop is still there, but if it is and you go, I recommend a stop. Okay, we are moving along here. Jennifer is going to be talking to us about Uganda. So you're ready? Jennifer Johnston with PHG Consulting. Thank you, Jennifer.
Hello, everybody. Good afternoon. PHG Consulting is the North America representative for Uganda Tourism. And we're very excited to be talking to you today about this beautiful destination, also another gem of Africa. In fact, Sir Winston Churchill coined it the Pearl of Africa. And it's... I'm going to show you some amazing photos. I didn't take them, but I can tell you, you cannot take a bad photo in Uganda. Like with many destinations in Africa, it's just every day is 100 photos without fail. It's the destination that I think is ideal if your clients have already been to another, maybe more tourist-established destination in Africa, perhaps South Africa, or another destination. It's just ideal for if you've already had that experience and now you want something a little bit more up close and personal, a bit more rugged. And it's just, the experiences are just tremendous. It's a real bucket list destination. The landscape is waterfalls, lakes, savannas, mountains, villages. It's just around every corner. It's just the most spectacular country. And also, besides the pretty obvious reason for going to see the Big Five game. Also, what I think makes it very unique is the cultural experiences that you can take place in or that you can take part of. And they're very authentic. The people there are very authentic. People want you to visit there from the cities to the villages. Very, very welcoming. And the government is doing a lot to increase tourism and bring more people to the destination. So I want to go back and just talk about that for a second when we get there. Where is it? It's in the Great Lakes region of East Africa. It's immediately bordered to the south of Kenya, Tanzania, and Rwanda. Very easy to get there. There's many international flights coming in with Brussels Airlines, KLM, Ethiopian, Emirates, and Qatar. You fly into Entebbe, which is just an hour in good traffic from Kampala, which is the major city. They are actually redoing the road into Kampala, so that will make it a lot easier to get into the city if the city is your first destination for your clients. However, if your clients are flying in the afternoon or the evening, there's plenty of great hotels right near the airport. They can rest up and then go straight back out to the airport next week, the next morning, to catch a charter flight to the parks. And when you think about, when I was thinking about coming here today and talking about why go to Africa, go to Uganda. Many people think, of course, of the Big Five, the Big Five game. And so I'm going to talk about my Big Five reasons for going. And my first reason, this is the most amazing experience in the world, to be up close with the gorillas. There's only about 900, give or take a few, gorillas left in natural habitat, and about half of them are in the Bawindi region of Uganda. Your clients can take a one-day trek, and they're in very small groups of only about 8 people, and you trek with guides, and they get you to, they trek them overnight, and they know where they left them the evening before, and take you back to that region, and you find this family of gorillas, and you're literally between here and where Janet is, and looking at this family of gorillas like this, and I could have taken this photo, truly. I mean, it's just amazing. You spend about an hour with them and just have this beautiful immersive experience with these gorillas, and it's breathtaking. Murchison Falls is a national park, or it's part of a national park system. You go there for game drives, cruises on the lake and in the river, seeing game from the boats, hiking up to the top of the falls, another spectacular destination. Queen Elizabeth Park is another very accessible and stunning national park to visit. They not only have the Big Five, they have these spectacular tree-climbing lions. Unfortunately, I didn't get to see one, so I'm just going to have to go back and try again. It's also UNESCO Biosphere Reserve. Again, the government doing a lot of work with different organizations to encourage growth and sustainability through different organizations around the world to help not only bring tourism, but to sustain and protect their wildlife and their way of life. Another great reason, it's a little on the same, the day after I did the gorilla trekking, I did chimpanzee trekking. Completely different experience. You think, oh, how different could it be? You have to run after the chimpanzees. With the gorillas, you're just standing there and saying, oh, hi, how's it going? And you're just looking at these magnificent creatures. And with the chimpanzees, you are running through the forest and through the jungle to keep up with these guys. And you just, again, spend an hour or two with them and learn all about them. And it's just a great experience. The other reason, I touched on it in the beginning, the cultural experience is really integrated into the tourism. Many of the lodges will sponsor local villages, and as part of your lodge fee, will actually go to the local villages to help with sewage, with electricity, with schooling. One of the lodges I stayed at sponsored a local village. The kids come up and do a dance and a song, and you think, oh, it's going to be kind of hokey. But it's not. It's very authentic and real, and these kids just enjoy it so much. And part of the fee, again, from the lodges goes to these villages to help with the education and infrastructure, et cetera. The other things you can do to get more involved with the villages and the local people, a lot of the villages will have walks that they will take you around and tell you about village life, how they live. You can see how they live day to day. There's some great co-op organizations. There's beekeeping businesses that the government helps these people learn about how to keep bees and how to make honey and how to make other byproducts, and then they sell them to tourists. And it's a real sustainability-focused business. So many more things to tell you about. It's very easy to get around. The government, as I said, is putting a lot of money into infrastructure. The roads need work. They are bad in places, but they're working on that. English is widely spoken, very easy to talk to people and get around, and they want you to come visit. For the games, it is very easy to get the permits for the parks. You have to get them in advance. The visa is also very easy. It's a $50 visa to get into just Uganda, or there's a tri-country visa for $100. You can either, and that covers Kenya, Rwanda, and Uganda. And you can either buy that ahead of time or buy it at the airport in cash. Birding, huge. If you've got birding clients, massive bird population, I guess. But it's a real birder's delight to go to visit Uganda. And even adventure sports. Outside of Kampala, there's a great destination for zip lining, bungee jumping, all those sorts of crazy things. So thank you very much.
I have to say, I have a friend who just got back from Uganda and seeing the gorillas, and she showed me her photographs, and they were incredible. They really were incredible. So thank you very much. That was very interesting. Okay, next up, we're focusing on Africa here. Our next country is Zimbabwe, and Graham Johnson from Wild Guides is going to talk to us about Zimbabwe. Thank you.
I'm going to sort of focus a little bit in this direction because I think you guys are all sitting right over here. Anyway, you'll hear the accents a little bit different, but it's great to be here and to be able to speak to you about Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe is one of those magnificent countries that's sort of fallen a bit off the radar over the last few years, and I'm very glad to be able to have the opportunity to come and try and bring it back to your notice. It's a small landlocked country between Botswana and Mozambique. It's got Zambia in the north and South Africa in the south. And without the ocean, it really tends to sort of fizzle out. There's been a few issues, I think, in conservation that have come to the media recently. And so we look at that in its own particular way. But I think what we have to look at are the highlights of the country. And it's one of those few parts of the world that actually have four UNESCO World Heritage Sites right situated, very easily accessible for visitors and tourism. And apart from a country that's probably got some of the biggest smiles in the world, I think it's great to be able to bring to light some of the more recent focuses of interest. But if you go back about 500,000 years, you'll see that there's a massive influence in an area called the Great Zimbabwe. It's about 30 kilometers south of a small town called Mazvingo, and you have this ancient city which was reputed to be the part of the Queen of Sheba's kingdom. We have an enormous area of about 800 hectares under these fascinating ruins. And you can see this picture with the great sort of Zimbabwean sky in the background where all of these hand-carved stones were eventually sort of broken up and put together to form an enormous fortress. This is part of the hill complex, which is where the kings and the chiefs would exist. And in a separate balcony within that region, you'd have these fascinating soapstone birds, which is very much a post with a big fish eagle type structure on the top, and this was seen to be a place of worship. It's still very, very important locally, and it recognizes the Shona culture dating back from about 1100 AD to about 1415 AD when the empire that existed in that particular time collapsed. And when you go there, especially on a full moon, it's a particularly scary and very sort of spooky place to be. But you hear the spirits of the past. And as a kid, I was very lucky enough to grow up around that area. The next place of particular interest, I think, is as we're talking about the big five, you know, wildlife in Africa. We do sunshine and big cats particularly well. And Hwenge National Park is the largest national park in Zimbabwe. It's about 14,650 square kilometers in area. It has the big five. It's particularly famous for its elephant. It has a herd of elephant that are protected by the president of Zimbabwe called the president's herd. And, of course, lion, sable, antelope, cheetah, and all the big game are prolific. Some fabulous small camps to spend time at. But I think, recognized back in the days of Mzilikazi, who was one of the early Matabele generals to take over that particular region. He was fleeing from the Zulu in the south and settled up in what we call today Matabele land. And he recognized this area as being perfect for his private royal hunting grounds. So with that, we have a lot of recognition with the environment, the people that live on the outside of the park. A lot of it was initially cattle ranches. So when it was established back in the 1950s, it took quite a bit of time to become what it is today. But today you'll find probably in the region of about 40,000 head of elephant, one of the largest herds of African elephant there. Staying with the people, it seems to be quite a bit of a thread, I think, with a lot of the World Heritage Sites. It all has to do with the abundance of of either culture or history or landscape, beauty. We have the Motobo Hills. The Motobo Hills is about 35 kilometers south of Bulawayo. Bulawayo is obviously one of those places where you might want to fly into to come in and land to move to either Motobos up to Hwangi. Bulawayo is quite famous for its very wide streets. And in the colonial days, you were able to actually turn an 18-span head of oxen around and do a big U-turn in the middle of the street. The streets were especially designed for that. It's Motobos means the place of bald heads, and was a place where Msilikazi was buried as the great chief of his day. He was also buried there with Cecil John Rhodes, who particularly had an affinity for the Matabele. They managed to settle an uprising and a war just with a shake of a hand, and that's still honored today, which is quite interesting. So where Rhodes is buried is a place called World's View, and it looks down over the valleys, which are filled with these massive granite kopjes, as we call them. And it's not only about the wildlife. There's black rhino, white rhino, and more of Zimbabwe's fabulous wildlife. But it's also about the rock art of the San. And the San people, you know, they existed there probably up until the late 1800s, early 1900s, where they generally got into conflict with a lot of people. But what they've left behind are these phenomenal panoramas of rock art, which generally depict not necessarily their daily livelihoods, but very much a sort of transient experience as though they were on drugs. But these people were particularly were spiritualists, and the rest of the tribe may have lived very much more nomadically. And again, it's a part of the country where you'll feel this strong depth of spiritual connectivity to Africa. And seeing we all know that we come from Africa, we know about Mrs. Pless and Lucy and all the paleoanthropology that's in our history today. It's a very good place to go and rediscover your roots. We have Mana Pools, which is down on the lower Zambezi. It's all part of the great Zambezi River system. Just opposite Zambia, there are these enormous pans that flood every year when the rains come down. Again, a phenomenal place for wildlife, particularly set aside because of its riparian environment. I've got to speak a little bit quicker. And also the fact that the black rhino were protected there. Sadly, you know, the rhino were protected in 1984, and today there are no black rhino left there because of poaching. So it's something that's being addressed. But you find wild dog, cheetah, it's some fabulous camps. You've got these massive acacia ana trees with shelter. And you can do safaris on a canoe. You can imagine being in this boat with that big jumbo right in front of you. It's quite a phenomenal, exciting experience. And you'll spend maybe about two or three nights sleeping on the beach with the crocodiles. Just checking to see who's paying attention over here. So on my last slide, we've of course got the Victoria Falls. You know, we talk about Brazil and Iguazu and all the fabulous falls of the world. And this is a big must that you have to have a bit of time at, because Victoria Falls is just over a mile long. It's about 1,700 kilometers. And it's an enormous trench where the Zambezi River falls right into and gradually works its way out through seven different rapids. And through a system of about 150 kilometers, probably some of the most spectacular river scenery and rapidry. You know, so, of course, you've got all of the extra sports, if you want to do bungee jumping, that they do at Victoria Falls as a town. But most importantly, it's recognized as a place of great importance because of the two national parks. You've got the Zambezi National Park in Zimbabwe and the Musio Tunya Park in Zambia. And with that, it protects a really important part of the Zambezi River stretch. Okay. All right. Thanks very much. I thought I was going to be quick.
I know we could stay forever, I'm sure, and listen and see more beautiful photographs, because those were amazing photographs. Thank you very much. Thank you, Graham. Yeah. But now Stacy is going to talk to us about Namibia, which is truly one of my favorite countries, so I can't wait to see the slides. I don't have to go step up. Thank you, Stacy. All right, so without further ado, let's learn about Namibia.
Hello, everyone. I'm going to try to be quick so I don't run out of time. Yeah. Okay, Namibia. Why Namibia? Very difficult to do in 5 slides, so I'm going to be very quick about it. Namibia is all about the landscapes. And to focus a little bit on those, you have the immense sand dunes of Sossus Vlei right here. You've got more sand dunes and history in the Skeleton Coast, for instance, which is world famous. Many ships have left their skeletons there. You have rock art and petrified forest in Twyfelfontein, in the Damara area. You have the amazing salt pans of Etosha National Park, and of course the waterholes and everything there. You've got this tiny little strip on the top of the country, which is the Caprivi Strip, quite different, sort of the Chobe Riverine type of environment. I mentioned earlier Damaraland, which is the dry land mass in the middle of the country. And then you've got the perennial river in the Kunini, up in the Kunini, that actually divides the Angola with Namibia. And cities, modern cities like Windhoek and also Swakopmund, both with very big German influence, because Namibia was a German colony. And again, English is widely spoken there. It is one of the official languages in Namibia, as is German, and of course local dialects as well. And that's what the amazing landscapes. Anybody who goes to Namibia really gets, yes, you do go a little bit for the wildlife, but that's not the main reason. You really go for the landscapes and the beauty of the country. The second one, of course, is the wildlife. Namibia does have wildlife, a lot of it, but it isn't the numbers that you see in East Africa. It isn't the numbers that you're going to see in Botswana or in other African countries. It is a drier country. You'll have perhaps the same number of species, but you just have them in a very different way. And I think one of the best parts about being the wildlife itself is the different types of wildlife that you see. So you may be in one of the Etosha waterholes, and you can see not only quite a pride of lions drinking water, but you can see a mix of another 10, 15 different species all in there. I was lucky enough to be there and to see 4 lions come into the waterhole, and the whole dynamic and how everything changed in terms of the wildebeest and the kudu and everything else that was in that waterhole. So that's part of what makes Namibia special too. Then you have the desert adapted elephants. You have the biggest elephants in Etosha. The biggest elephants in Africa are in Etosha National Park. You have cheetah, you have amazing birding, like the black-bellied koran, for instance, is one of them. It's a heaven for rhino conservation. And you have endemics, like the black-faced impala, for instance, in Etosha National Park. Conservation. Namibia is famous for its conservation work. You're looking at Lori Marker. She's the world's authority. She's an American, but the world's authority on cheetah. And her life's mission has been to conserve the cheetah. You also have rhino conservation, and Save the Rhino Trust is located right there. You have elephant conservation at Ungava. You've got vultures that are being studied and conservation in Oji-Wurrungur. And then the Lion Project, for instance, in the Skeleton Coast. You wouldn't think that anything can exist in the Skeleton Coast, and yet they do. And after the conservation work went into effect, the number of lions actually increased and came back. They had disappeared for like 15 years, and they came back because of the conservation. So it's a real success story. Namibia is also the experiences. You have very, very different experiences. So you have rhino trekking, for instance, and that's how you do it. Your ranger will go out, will find the rhinos, and then you actually can approach them quite closely, carefully, but closely, to see them. You have the desert elephants, where you go out for the day and you really look for them, and it's an amazing experience as well. Skeleton Coast. You can go to the Skeleton Coast to see the seals, to see the wrecks of the ships, to see so many different things, and so inaccessible and different. You've got marine experiences. So, for instance, if you are in Squakamon, you go out on a marine excursion, and you can see the seals, and you can see the penguins, and you can see the cormorants, and you can see so much more. And you can look for welwitschias, the ancient plants that can be 1,000 years old, and you can find them in the desert. And of course, if you go up in the Caprivi, for instance, you can do the boating experiences and all of the different things that exist that are more in a riverine environment. And Lastly, I have to say something about the people. How can I miss the people? These are the Himba. The Himba are one of the most inaccessible tribes in the world. They live on nothing. They live on sand. They live on their cattle, and I guess whatever tourism brings into them. But they are beautiful people. They are wonderful, photogenic people. Everybody goes and buys something from them because they absolutely, it's one of the experiences. Very, very, as I said, inaccessible. And you also have the sand people there. You even have all of the misplaced people, because I can't say the name. Say the name, Graham? The people who moved into... Say that again? Okay, I can't say that name. They're the ones who were misplaced from apartheid, and they were they were settled in the Damara area. And of course, you have the Germans and the farmers and that whole flavor. So Namibia is a real, complete, very different experience to any other African experience you have. And I'm sorry if I ran over, but this thing timed out.
Someone's lost their tags. Was that you? I think it is you. It is you. Oh, my gosh. All right. And I remember driving once in Namibia, and we drove for 5 hours and never saw another car or another person for 5 hours. It was amazing. All right. Next, we are moving continents. We are leaving Africa, sadly, but moving on now to Asia. And Yasin Zargad is going to talk about India, and Yasin is with Indus Discoveries. So thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to talk a little about a treasure in southern India, but please could I ask a question? How many of you have been or have heard of Bangalore? Could you please raise your hands? Particular reason for Bangalore? Bangalore is known as the IT hub of India. And the most recent news is that Apple is going to firstly assemble the mobile phones in Bangalore, and in stage two, manufacture mobile phones in Bangalore. But very few people know that this is one of the most culturally rich and geographically diverse states in India, called Karnataka. Stretching from the beaches of Konkan coast on the Arabian Sea to the hill stations of the Western Ghats and the fertile rivers of the Deccan Plateau, Karnataka has been inhabited since Paleolithic times and was the center of numerous kingdoms. The most significant of these was the medieval Vijayanagara Empire, and the ruins of their capital at Hampi is one of India's most exceptional sites. Hampi, archaeological site. The global importance of Hampi is recognized by UNESCO, and it has been designated a World Heritage Site. At its peak in the 1500s, it was the second largest city of the world after Beijing and was home to 500,000 people. The principal structures, seven lines of fortifications, gateways, temples, shrines, and even aqueducts survive and in far better condition than comparable sites such as Cambodia's Angkor Wat. The new Kalada Museum, which is a fascinating wonder, I was there 2 months before, an Australian photographer has put a collection of 2,000 photographs and worked with the two more experts to create this beautiful site with a life of 3D panorama and interactive technology so that the visitors can explore the streets of Hampi as it would have been, complete with multisensory encounters. And the museum is set up in the middle of a steel mining factory, a fantastic site. Hampi Chariot. Hampi is not about just the past, it's the place of pilgrimage and living traditions, part of India's intangible cultural heritage. The three-day Hampi festival each November is a chance for guests to witness processions, music and dance, puppet shows and fireworks. There's a classical music festival in February, major celebrations of Diwali in October, and significantly religious festivals throughout the year, when idols of the gods and goddesses are carried through the streets on wooden chariots pulled by costumed devotees. It's a fascinating sight. One of the most significant things about these chariots and the temple architecture is how they used the rainwater of monsoon in India to create the best panoramic views and effects. When the rain would fall on these beautiful temple structures, they would have curtains of different colors, and the architecture of the rain would technically allow the raindrops to stay. I need to just show you the particular place, if I may. If you look down here and here, these were the stone architectural just tapered down to hold the rainwater drops. You just have to imagine the site. When the rain would fall and the rain drops would hang around, and then when the sun would shine, what a beautiful view it could provide of these fascinating structures. It is something to imagine and to think about. Then we have the Serai in Chikmagalur. India is not much known for coffee, but this is the part of India where coffee is grown in abundance. And the wonderful story is that this pilgrim, a Sufi saint from that particular region, when he would go to pilgrimages to Mecca, he smuggled 7 beans of coffee in his walking stick because the Arabs never wanted the secret to go. And he started coffee plantation in India with these 7 beans of coffee. Coffee Arabica is the name. There are 2 coffees, Arabica and Robusta. This is how coffee was brought in India, and it is in Karnataka where coffee and spices are grown in their states, the pepper actually. And in Chikmagalur, there is a coffee museum. I spent 2 hours learning the history and seeing this because coffee is not very synonymous in India, and a lot of it is grown and exported. The hotel, Serai Chikmagalur, is a fascinating luxury to experience, to stay within the coffee estates. Rising above the plains of Hampi, Karnataka's climate, cooler, moist, ideal for growing spice and coffee, there are beautiful routes for hiking on the plantations. You can learn about the production methods of Coffee Museum and try the products in factories. Guests have the opportunity to engage their senses and taste and smell, as well as to use their eyes and ears. It is a multisensory experience. It's also possible to stay in the coffee estate, the Sarai Chikmagalur, one of the most exclusive hotels and spas in southern India. Karaikalride. The natural landscapes are one of Karnataka's biggest draws. They are dramatic and diverse. In the national parks, it is possible to see tiger in the wild, plus some of the largest elephants in India. For a completely different way of seeing the waterways and their wildlife, we take guests on a Karaikal ride along the Tungabhadra River. The Karaikal, a small round leather boat, is a traditional means of transport in this area of India. Orange County, one of the Karnataka's great charms. Here you can immerse yourself in history, ancient sites, historic buildings, or not just places to visit, take photographs off and leave. Traditions of music, dance, and theater might date back thousands of years, but they are still practiced and evolving. And guests, too, can stay in heritage buildings inspired by ancient places, colonial bungalows, and tribal villages, even sleeping in the Zenana, the Queen's quarters at the new Orange County in Hampi. Karnataka boasts a wealth of attractions which easily rival those of India's Golden Triangle, but which are far less well known. Karnataka is my number one destination recommendation for travel in India in 2018 and 2019. I hope you would consider sending your clients to this state of India. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you very much. Beautiful photographs. Thank you. All right, so we are going to move now to Indochina. And Jonathan Morana from Secret Indochina is going to show us some interesting slides, I hope. Yeah?
Good afternoon, everybody. So it will be a little bit different than other presentation because basically my five photos are only about people. We could have listed all UNESCO heritage of Indochina, but we won't show that. We won't only show the people here. We got the Cham people here first. We'll talk about that later. But Indochina is a region, not a country. So I'll break a little bit the rule of today's session to talk about a region of contrast, a region of diversity, a region of 12 UNESCO World Heritage, including 8 in Vietnam, 2 in Cambodia, and 2 in Laos. A region that actually only reveals its charm through its people. That's why we chose today to show you 5 pictures of people. A region that in terms of offer in itineraries offer unique versatility. Because geographically, it has a lot to offer, from the Mystic Mountain of the north with the terrestrial fields to the paradise islands of South Cambodia. And I don't speak about the charm of the landscape, very rolling and lush landscape of Laos. It's a region that have a lot of common points talking about the history, and that's great. I talk about after India, actually, because Indochina is coming from this mutual meetup of cultural influences from India and from China. Indochina is also the name that French colonials choose to be when they rule the region under different kingdoms. Today, those three countries are definitely linked, and again, through its geographical, but also through its people. When we speak about Indochina, it's over 54 ethnic groups. Some of them are proto-Indochinese, what we believe the native people of Indochina. This a Cham people that was Cham Kingdom in the South Vietnam before, while the north was Chinese dynasties. That's the kingdom, Cham people. This is what we will see in Angkor temples, in all carvings showing the fight and the battles between the Khmer and the Cham. Cham people are again something to see. It's a minority today, not very showcased. And this is what really is about today, my presentation, is that we know very well all those sites. We know very well Along Bay, it's 5 million tourists per year. We know very well Angkor Wat, 3 million tourists per year. We know very well Ho Chi Minh City, the Mekong Delta, and its floating markets. But today it's important to give you an update of what's happening. Our creator co-founder that used to be here at EDC arrived in Vietnam 25 years ago, in Indochina, let's say, because he was already traveling across the three countries. At that time, it was a region full of beauty. You could see tigers. You could see, like, elephants. You could see, like, beautiful tribe villages. Tourism, Halong Bay, was just stunning. Everything you could, everywhere you could see beauty. Today, it's important to have a realistic point of view of, for example, this Halong Bay with 4 to 5 million people per year who travel by boats. And what we want to show you today, representing Indochina, is the alternative solution. So we spoke about Sapa, which is also a featured destination. You may know it for its terrace rice fields. It's also something, an image that we have of Indochina, the terrace rice fields, surely the most beautiful in the world indeed. But when we speak about terrace rice fields, it's only about one place called Sapa, but actually North Vietnam have plenty of them. North East Vietnam, the opposite of Sapa. And those regions, Cao Bang, Haziang provinces, are the one worth to visit. And I think my network, minus like about Cambodia. But speaking about Cambodia is the same. We all go to Siem Reap, we all see Angkor temples, but Angkor temples and Cambodia, which actually means Kampuchea, country made of water, it's all history is based on Tonle Sap Lake. It's a great half day that usually mass tourists do from Siem Reap going to one of the very touristic villages. But the lake is huge, place of incredible birds, alive, flooded forest, flora and flora, incredible. Source and harm, it has between Siem Reap and Phnom Penh, where people usually fly. If they don't sleep on the flight of 45 minutes, they may see at the lake. But source and harm of the lake, you got villages here like this, welcoming guests, offering cultural immersion, because this is what it's about Indochina. It's not about just going to see sites, but it's about experiential travel. It's not about visiting a village, but it's about living like a local and having those experiences. Going in the rice fields, going fishing, participating in the daily life. Of course, we cannot skip the highlights, but let's see it differently. How we can make Angkor temples differently, not maybe going for that sunrise photo, that's actually great for Angkor Wat, but well, it has many groups of Asian tourists, so the photo looks great, but in terms of experience. But maybe we could join archaeologists going to that site. Halong Bay is huge. Bay Tulong Bay, Lanha Bay are parts of the bay that nobody goes to. But there are boats. They're only waiting for your guests. Those boats are there. They're not the boats that you may see often on itineraries that you can browse easily on the internet. But those boats are comfortable and waiting for your Bay Tulong Bay or Lanha Bay experiences. The name is a little bit different, but the landscape is the same. So alternative creativity is today needed. I think I'm running out of time. So that's, I think, the last photos is also about our Indonesia's tour guide, because this is what is important to bring again those people, ethnic minorities living. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Nice to see the country, the three countries really portrayed through the people. Enjoyed that. Thank you. Okay, last but not least, Stephanie, where are you? There you are. Yes, so we have Stephanie Schneiderman from Tia Stephanie Tours, who is going to talk to us about Mexico. Thank you.
Okay, so we're back, going back to the Western Hemisphere. I don't know if that was on purpose to bookend us, but here we are. So put on your seatbelts, get ready. Here we go to one of my favorite countries, Mexico. Mexico, has everybody been? Anybody not been? Who's been? Okay. So one of the things I love about Mexico is that it is almost like saying there are 30 different countries in the same country. Every experience going there is different, depending on what region, what state. It's really got tremendous diversity. For us, we like to begin the story of Mexico with its topography. So, and in that, we like to say, when you're traveling to Mexico, make sure you get a window seat. because it's there you start seeing these vast mountain chains, the Sierra Madres, that sweep across the country. And then in the middle of these mountain chains is what's called the Central High Plateau. So I've had the great fortune of living and traveling there for over 30 years. And still to this day, everybody says, did you pack your bathing suit? Do you have your sunscreen? And I try to let them know most of Mexico is at between, I would say, 5 and 7,000 feet. So we'll begin our journey in a point of port of entry for a lot of trips into Mexico is Mexico City. So Mexico City is truly one of the great capital cities of the world. And I'm so happy to know that it's truly, finally being discovered. This is a city that it took a while to explain to people because I think media has not always been friendly to this destination. And but now we're seeing a lot of great media on Mexico, and it's not false. So just on my flight down here today, did anybody fly on Southwest Airlines? I was really, really, really happy to see this. I casually just went into my, you know, the seat pocket very casually, and then I was not so casual. I was like, whoa, Mexico. So this issue highlights all of the great things that I wanted to talk about and will talk about in this presentation. Mexico City, it is a mecca, epicenter for art and cuisine. And here we see art that is not necessarily art in a museum. The art in Mexico City is on the walls. It's on the walls of the historic buildings, beginning in the 1920s with a very important art movement that was called Mexican muralism. And the big three proponents, Diego Rivera, Orozco, and Siqueiros. Here we're seeing Man at the Crossroads. This is in the Palace of Fine Arts, Mexico City. Does anyone know where this was originally going to be? Okay, this was scheduled. This was slated for Rockefeller Center, commissioned by John D. Rockefeller. And when Diego Rivera snuck in a picture of Lenin, then that put the kibosh on it. So tumbling down came this mural, but Diego Rivera said, that's okay, I'll repaint it in Mexico City. So Mexico City is a city of about 20 million people. Again, it's a great destination, art, cuisine, about 164 museums. Leaving Mexico City, we enter into some of the hinterland. It's not hinterland. Basically, we go to what we call the provinces, towns. Here we have Oaxaca. Oaxaca is a fabulous destination that also was in this magazine about mole sauce. And so here we have a market in, it's called the Benito Juarez Market in Oaxaca City. Oaxaca is a place that, it's a mecca for regional cuisine, but it's also where the very first cuisines of Mexico started, about 8,000 years ago, about 6,000 BC. This is where the first domesticated corn was found, and the trilogy of corn, squash, and beans that have been the foundation of Mesoamerica can all be seen readily in Oaxaca. So here we see all the different chili peppers that also go into the wonderful mole sauces. Traveling further into Mexico, going south, Mexico, as you know, is at a diagonal, so usually everything is either going northwest or southeast. Here, we're going southeast, but then going up on the peninsula, this is Yucatan. And Yucatan is an incredible destination. Again, if you go to Yucatan, you almost feel like you're in a different place. It's not anything like you would have experienced in Mexico City. So it's like a different country. The food is different. The landscapes are different. Here, our travelers enjoy, and we highly recommend, pondering the mysteries of the Maya and the ancient civilizations that first inhabited this land called Mesoamerica. So the questions are, what happened to the Maya? Why did they abandon their sites? Did they run out of water? Did they Did they lose faith in their political systems? What happened? And then we finally ask the question, where are the Maya? And we answer that with nowhere. They're still here. And that's one of the beautiful things about traveling to Mexico, is that ability to very directly combine past and present. So we see the ancient sites, but we also see the living cultures. Mexico, 10% of Mexico is indigenous, ethnic landscape, and they all speak a unique language. It's not a dialect, it's a language. They all have different dress, so it's very fascinating that you can be 5 minutes from one town to the other, but their dress in Mexico is known as what I like to call a cultural passport. If these women were walking into Mexico City, everybody would know that they are Amusco women. They come from the Amusco culture. They are found in both Oaxaca and Guerrero. And I've met women in Mexico City wearing their dress, and I've asked them, you know, are you Amusco? And they started crying because they didn't know how I knew. And I said, well, because you're wearing that beautiful, beautiful textile that identifies you. The other thing about Mexico, in addition to, I mean, the living cultures are still very involved in their traditions and rituals. Here we see an image of Day of the Dead. I'm sure you've heard of it. But Day of the Dead is one of the most interesting festivals and rituals in Mexico. That really, it's a syncretic festival that combines the ancient pre-Hispanic beliefs of the underworld and the Catholic dates that kind of merged with the Gregorian calendar, or I think it's the Gregorian calendar. So when you go to Mexico, you see this tremendous fusion of the two worlds, the pre-Hispanic world, the indigenous world, and then the arrival of the Spanish that then led to what they call the great mestizaje, this blend of cultures. So traveling to Mexico is like going to many different countries, and it's so close. You can hop on a plane and be there in 3.5-4 hours. It also lends itself to really nice short haul, short trips, great for millennial travel, 6 nights Mexico City, 6 nights Mérida. It's a great destination, and we hope if you've seen it, you see it again, because it is you can go deep and wide in Mexico, and it never ends. Thank you. Yes. Well, this is Otomi. Otomi from Hidalgo. It's from the Nahua people. Thank you. But one thing I'll say, this design has been appropriated a lot. I don't know if you've seen, but I think it was Crate and Barrel, either Crate and Barrel or Pottery Barn, came out with pillows. And so this is a big thing that is become an issue now. It's called cultural appropriation. That the countries that, you know, the people who are really the authors of this don't get credit, and then Crate and Barrel gets to use it for free. anyway.
Okay. And just another interesting thing, Stephanie, I don't know if you saw it, but I don't know if any of you read the English newspaper, The Guardian, but I'm a big fan. Yesterday, they did an incredible article, Stephanie, called The Hidden Yucatan. It's about a group of people who are sort of trying to bring tourism back to the people and get the locals to open the hotels, you know, get away from the fancy five-star, take them to the cenotes that nobody goes to ruins that people don't know about. So Hidden Yucatan and The Guardian yesterday. Anyway, thank you all very much for coming. Wonderful presentations. I know that I am interested in places that I hadn't thought about, so hope the rest of you got some inspiration and some ideas. Please fill out the evaluation forms. That's very important for the ETC organizers to know what worked and what didn't work. And thank you very much again. A round of applause to all our presenters. Thank you. And the next session in here is the mentor meet and greet. So that's for newcomers who are going to get a lowdown on what the conference is about. And then we have meeting your mentors later on. But thank you again for coming.